This is WMRA's Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom this week. I'm Bob Levicky.
I like judging goats.
My strength in judging would have to be cattle.
Oh gosh, my favorite. I don't know. I like to judge pigs.
That's three of the four high schoolers from the Shenandoah Valley who are now national champion livestock judges. And they're heading to Scotland to compete with students from around the world. We've got that story from Andrew Jenner. And Luann Austin takes a look at the visual arts in Stanton and, in a replay from last year, the arts scene in Harrisonburg. And Martha Woodruff has a conversation with jubilant one-legged skier Seth Whitten. That's this week's episode of The Spark. Stay tuned for Second Look, but first, this news from NPR. This is WMRA's Second Look, a look back at some of the stories and conversations from the WMRA newsroom this week. I'm WMRA's news director, Bob Levicky. First, a story from Luann Austin that got a lot of play on the WMRA Public Radio Facebook page this week. She took us to Stanton, where from tiny, out-of-the-way workshops to the better-known art galleries, the visual arts play a big role in Stanton's cultural life and in the tourist experience.
That is the sound of an artist applying paint to canvas. June Jordan, a student at Beverly Street Studio School in Stanton, is repairing an old painting, vigorously covering a dark spot with pale yellow. Jordan is one of the many students who have studied at the school since 1992. Since that time, Ron Bomer, a co-founder, has seen the visual arts expand in Stanton.
It has grown, and I would like to think that we had a lot to do with that. Because what we brought and what the idea of the school was to bring a very serious intention of quality education for people who really wanted to become painters. And we were successful with that.
Downtown Stanton has a thriving art scene. As Bomer points out, part of the reason is the city's location at the crossroads of Interstates 81 and 64. From music to theater to the visual arts, many events and exhibits keep the community calendar full. Visitors who come for a show at the American Shakespeare Center find the downtown's architecture and art galleries to be a visual feast. As a matter of fact, it was Stanton's art and beauty that made artist Cleveland Morris want to move here.
One of the reasons I moved here, in addition to the glorious scenery and beautiful architectural preservation and the natural lay of the land and the light that you get here, is I was passing through town just as a traveler on my way to someplace else, and I walked up Beverly Street one day and I saw a sign on a battered old doorway, my kind of doorway, I should say, peeling paint and dents and nicks. And it was announcing that there was an open studio there twice a week, Monday evenings and Friday mornings. Now, if you're an artist, that's a sign that it's a welcome mat. It means there are serious artists here.
That open studio continues to be offered by Mary Eccles, a co-founder of the Beverly Street School, national award-winning artist, and art professor emeritus at Mary Baldwin College. Serious artists do live here, as do art appreciators and students. Galleries and art-related businesses abound. The city's oldest art institution is the Stanton Augusta Art Center, founded in 1962. It has spacious galleries, a reception area, and a gift shop. In her 9 years as the center's executive director, Beth Hodge has seen many changes in the city's art scene.
And it's grown in quantity, but it's also grown in quality. It's been especially interesting to watch the sophistication of all of us, our residents, our professionals, our administrators like myself. And we have now a number of galleries in town, which is absolutely wonderful.
Each gallery in Stanton has its own personality. The Stanton Augusta Art Center generally offers fine art exhibits, but also community-wide opportunities to participate. The Co-Art Gallery features the work of more than 40 area artists, as well as students from the Beverly Street School. One of the city's new galleries is the Dwell Collective. Steve Kaiser and his three partners have been doing live art together at Stanton's outdoor events and represent a less traditional approach. Last year, they made a real splash in the downtown art scene when they opened a storefront gallery.
I think over the past few years, there have been a few attempts at more contemporary, kind of edgier, newer art as compared to the traditional landscape. Sometimes it seemed that there was a little bit of angst of the younger crowd against that. And we got together and we never felt any of that. And so once we started a year ago, we were really embraced by the community to pursue this type of art and this type of scene in the city that people downtown sort of really backed us and wanted this type of element around the community.
Of course, art sells here. At an opening in January at the Stanton Augusta Art Center, Cleveland Morris unveiled a new still life collection he calls Locally Sourced.
I have 24 works in this show, of which 13 have currently sold. So I'm very, very pleased. I'm very grateful. But it's also important for the gallery to be able to sell work, too, because they have expenses. Somebody has to pay to put those beautiful spotlights on the work and keep the space open and heated and so forth. And so there's always an element of commerce to art. So, yes, it is a good place. I think Stan is a good place to sell your work.
Locals are not the only ones who buy art here. Visitors and tourists often make purchases at the city's galleries too, says Beth Hodge.
Now that we're a tourist destination for the arts, that means that we're clearly making an economic impact on the city of Stanton. And I think our legislators and city council people, board of supervisors, are certainly recognizing that and supporting us however they can.
For WMRA News, I'm Luann Austin.
Now, Luann Austin also took a look at the art scene in Harrisonburg last year. In case you missed it, here's a replay. Turns out, quite a few people have been working pretty hard at growing the arts in Harrisonburg. And that goes hand in hand with the effort to revitalize downtown.
For many years, the art scene in downtown Harrisonburg could be described as fragmented. Valley Playhouse offered live theater and makeshift locations. The Little Grill could be counted on for live music. An Oasis featured fine arts and crafts. But many shops and restaurants had closed or moved to strip malls, so there wasn't much to draw visitors downtown. Over the past decade, that has changed. The city's downtown has become the place to go for art, poetry readings, theater, film, music, and shopping and dining. So how did the Turkey Capital of Virginia pull off this transformation? Eddie Bumbaugh is Executive Director of Harrisonburg Downtown Renaissance.
Harrisonburg Downtown Renaissance was formed in 2003. Just prior to that, the Arts Council of the Valley was formed. And I think what that demonstrates is there was interest on the part of local government as well as citizens to support both arts and downtown revitalization. And frankly, I think the two are related.
In 2004, a biannual museum and gallery walk was started and became so popular that 3 years later, the Arts Council turned it into a monthly event, First Fridays Downtown. In the meantime, an underground music scene was happening in Harrisonburg that attracted lots of artistic young people.
So what we're seeing now kind of surging is still elements of that young, aesthetic-minded, creative, you know, little bit of attitude, art scene.
That was Paul Summers, a poet and artist who, in 2009, founded Skatin' Worshippers, an exhibit showcasing the aesthetics of skateboard culture. He and filmmaker Tim Eastep were impressed with the exhibit's quality of work, quantity of entries, and community support. That's when they came up with the idea for the Super Great Film Festival.
It was a tipping point because after that, it introduced all these people to each other. And, you know, Tim and I kind of facilitated linking people up as much as we could, like, oh, you want to make a film? Well, I know a guy that, you know, he said he might be interested in acting in a film. And so you have all these little filmmaking teams that form out of that, made up of people that previously did not know each other, but are all creative people working in the arts at some level, be it professionally or in their spare time.
Collaboration seems to be the norm here. Art Lotto brings artists together to create an annual multimedia show, and Court Square Theater has partnered with Valley Playhouse and Stanton's Visualite Theater to add plays and films to its offerings. Manager Michael Weaver says all shows at the theater are well attended.
The biggest factor was that we're now open 7 days a week.
The city now has numerous galleries, museums, art and music stores, recording studios, and film production companies.
Downtown as a whole has just been snowballing in everyone's efforts, whether they're an individual or a organization or a business, just keep building on each other. And so downtown continues to thrive, and then we're all benefiting from that as well.
For WMRA News, this is Lou Ann Austin.
And to paraphrase Justice Potter Stewart about a different topic, we may not be able to define good art, but we know it when we see it. And one thing most of us are pretty good at is determining the physical characteristics that make people look fit and healthy. But most of us would have no idea how to make that same judgment about a pig. The four high schoolers on the championship-winning Rockingham County 4-H livestock judging team are getting ready to compete in Scotland this summer, developing all sorts of valuable life skills along the way. WMRA's Andrew Jenner has this roundup.
I placed the market hogs 1, 2, 3, 4. As it turned to the class, I was quick to find the blue butt bear to win, as he's the most open in his chest floor, most pulled apart in his blade, and continues out into the most powerful hip and ham. Now the litter 7 Gill is leveler out of her hip. She's wider bladed, stouter topped. However, she simply can't...
Pulled apart blade, chest floor, stouter topped? Let's slow down a little bit.
My name is Kaylee Ellington. I'm 17 years old, and I go to Broadway High School.
She's a member of the Rockingham County 4-H Livestock Judging Team, and you just heard her practicing a set of reasons. That's a defense of the way she ranked a hypothetical group of market hogs. Here's some explanation of the intense vocabulary of competitive livestock judging.
A gilt is a female hog, and then a barrow is a castrated male hog.
In a market class, you're basically looking for the ones that will end up giving you the best cuts of meat.
So I said the wider-bladed, stouter-topped gilt. Their blade is their shoulder. You want them wider down their top, so that would mean that they had more meat. And stouter-topped gilt is just more muscle expression down her top. Just like in people, if someone's really muscular, you can see kind of the shape in their back. That's pretty much the same thing, only in hogs. You just have to learn to pick out the good traits versus the bad traits.
That's something Ellington and the three others on the county judging team have gotten very, very good at doing. Last month, they took first place at the Western National Roundup in Denver.
That was a huge highlight of my judging career. I've heard about Denver my whole life, and to actually get out there and get to judge good livestock and then win was an amazing experience.
It's one of the biggest contests in the country, so winning it is a major accomplishment of its own. But it also means that in June, the team will go to Scotland to compete at the International Livestock Judging Tour. Big judging competitions involve four kinds of animals: cattle, sheep, pigs, and goats, further broken down into market and breeding classes. Each one has its own set of criteria to evaluate, and it can take years to get a feel for the nuances that separate one cow from the next.
I like judging goats.
My strength in judging would have to be cattle. I was raised on a beef cattle farm, so just being around cattle all my life has helped me gain on my knowledge as what to look for in a market class or in a breeding class or vice versa.
Oh gosh, my favorite. I don't know. I like to judge pigs.
Those were team members Bailey Carpenter, Michaela Nesselrod, and Hannah Cron, whose different strong suits are part of their overall team success.
When we come together and all our scores are come together, if somebody had a bad day in one place, another person can pick up their bad day. So definitely working as a team and having different backgrounds definitely makes us stronger as a team together.
Coaches Dave Walker and Tammy Cron, that's Hannah's mother, have been leading the team together for about 25 years. Before that, Walker and Cron were livestock judging teammates at Virginia Tech. And before that, they competed together on this very same Rockingham County 4-H team. Cron called the win in Denver the biggest one the team has ever scored.
We were just really excited and really proud of the kids. They've been practicing every week since August.
They'll be practicing a lot more until they leave for Scotland. They'll also be working hard to raise money for the trip from civic groups, agribusiness, and others. Both aspects of that preparation, the coaches say, help turn members of today's livestock judging team into tomorrow's leaders of Rockingham County's biggest industry, farming. Here's Nesselrod again.
lifestyle judging definitely teaches us life skills that we'll always use. It teaches us decision making. It teaches us great public speaking by giving oral reasons, saying why we placed the class the way we did. It definitely gives us life skills that we'll use for the rest of our lives.
She also drives the ring with more flex and ease off of both ends.
For WMRA News, I'm Andrew Jenner.
Now, sure, the belted gilt is longer spined, but unfortunately, she's the narrowest driving, flattest made hog of the drive, leading me to question her endpoint value. Thank you.
Now, to Martha Woodruff's conversation with Seth Witten, who lost his leg in an accident when he was 14 and later went on to become a jubilant skier.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. 33-year-old Seth Witten, who works as a specialist and production supervisor at Friendship Industries, is also a three-track ski instructor with Wintergreen Adaptive Skiing. Seth came in to talk to me, one pants leg rolled up, sporting both a peg leg and a staggeringly positive attitude about being an amputee.
I lost my leg when I was 14 in an accident with a train here in Harrisonburg. The peg leg initially was a Halloween costume. At a certain point, feet are expensive. They're so expensive. And as a civilian, you know, dealing with the morass that has been and is our health insurance system, you kind of figure things out. It's always been very important, obviously, for me to have health insurance. And and I do have a foot, you know, that when I go on business kind of outings or whatever, I try to wear my foot. But
hey, this is business.
That's well, you know, I figured you would appreciate it. But yeah, the peg leg, it's great. Really where I wear it the most these days is when I'm on the hill in the wintertime because I'm a three-tracker. I ski on one ski with outriggers. And so my ski pants are stitched up, you know, about 6 inches below my knee. And it's really nice to be able to come in off the hill and not have to go to the restroom and, you know, take your pants down and deal with the sleeves and everything else that affects a more heavy-duty prosthetic, I guess. Also, it's good for people. I mean, I really believe that, you know, for people to see somebody literally walking around on a stick, they go, wait, that's kind of cool. And for me, I mean, I can put on a foot and pants and walk down the street and nobody
pass.
Pass, exactly. And because of, you know, what I do professionally, what I do in my extracurricular, I mean, I deal with a number of people who can't pass like that. And so I feel like it is good for people to kind of have it in their face and be in a situation where they go, wow, that's really neat. And if only for a moment, maybe around Halloween, they see it and they go, wow, that would be really great if you wanted to be a pirate. And, you know, maybe they're wishing that they were like me.
Oh, honey, I think that's optimistic, but it's nice. Okay, you're 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You lose your leg in what must have been a horrific accident.
It could have been a lot worse.
Right? But you're 14. You're a 14-year-old guy with one leg.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
14 is a great age to cut off limbs. For anybody out there who's thinking of having it done, 14, get it done then. You know, not that you don't have a self-image or a, you know, identity developed as a human being, but being an adolescent like that, you know, I didn't know how to drive a car. I didn't know how to ride a skateboard or a snowboard. All these things that, you know, would later come into my life, I learned to do with a prosthetic leg. And I think about, you know, our young men and women who are coming back from our conflicts overseas who are, you know, 18, 19, 20, 25, however old it is. And, you know, when I got hurt, all I had to learn to do again was walk. And it was honestly kind of strange when you get up and, you know, get your first leg and you're going, wait, I've got to learn to walk again? No, I know how to walk. But it wasn't all of the things that, you know, define me as a human being in terms of I can drive and I like to go running and everything, you know, that I think about as being a young adult in your early 20s, that it really it's a sea change in a lot of ways. And you've got to reconceive your notion of your identity, you know? And so that's where, again, I mean, the adaptive sports and things like this come in and really open doors. I hear so often people say, I thought my life was over. And we're able to take people and say, no, no, no. There's a lot of great stuff out here.
Tell me about you and sports.
I'm small of stature, vertically challenged, I think, is the preferred nomenclature these days. I was a baseball player in Little League, never very good. There's actually a great story about my Pony League baseball team. That was the year that I lost my foot, and they put me on the all-star team because, you know, over the course of the season, I didn't have a leg yet. And there was one time they made me hit and hop to first base. And after that, they decided, ooh, that doesn't look good. We'll give him a runner from the plate. And so they did that. And, you know, everybody's going, oh, wow, what a brave kid. Like, how awesome. And
I would have.
To me, you know, it's life. And you don't have a choice. You can lay down and feel really sorry for yourself, or you get it together and figure out what's next. Got into skiing that year after I lost my foot. I took my first three-track lesson up at Massanutten with their program. And when we talk three-track, we're talking again about one ski, no foot, and outriggers. And it's a beautiful way to ski. It's amazing.
No foot.
No foot.
What does that mean?
So I'm skiing without my foot on one leg with outriggers.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah,
you've got a foot down there.
I have a foot. Yeah, and that's why we call it three track. It's
okay.
how many tracks does it leave in the snow as you ski like this? And then we've also got four track where, you know, somebody with maybe limited motion in their ankles or all sorts of different balance issues will ski with two legs with two outriggers, and that's four track.
But you're a three track.
I'm a three tracker. I was actually a skier and snowboarder. I was more of a snowboarder. It's a pretty typical thing for somebody with my injury to be able to ride a snowboard because you have your knee. And because they make feet that'll work to, you know, put that pressure on your heel or your toe that you need to flex the snowboard. So in college, I took a gym class and had actually moved away from this three-track thing after breaking some feet and realizing, wow, I've got to pay for these every time I break them. I kind of became more enamored with my three-track. I actually was just looking to get on the mountain. I love to be out. I was actually three-tracking one day while I was at UVA up at Wintergreen, and the founder of that program, Michael Zuckerman is his name, and he was the executive director for a number of years, really awesome individual, stopped me and he said, hey, who the heck are you? What are you doing here? And I said, I'm Seth. I live in Harrisonburg. He said, well, you need to come teach with us. Like, come on, what are you doing? And it took me years, actually. It was probably another 4 or 5 years before I was over at my prosthetics place in Charlottesville and saw a brochure that was about the Wintergreen Adaptive Sports Program. And I picked it up.
Did you not take him seriously?
I don't know. I was early 20s and, you know, self-absorbed and whatever it was.
You were early 20s. Okay.
It didn't grab me right away. And honestly, it didn't grab me until I went, you know, I'd really like to ski this year, and the season pass is expensive, and, you know, working nonprofit, I don't have a lot of disposable income to say, oh, I'll just buy a several hundred dollar season pass for the year. And I kind of realized if I teach, I can get up there and I can teach and have some free time to play. But then they also, Wintergreen Resort is an amazing partner for us. And for each of our volunteer instructors, every day that you work, you get a comp lift ticket. And so it was that incentive that originally
got you into
kind of dragged me into it. And, you know, even over the course of that first year, I just became so enamored with what we were doing and the change that we were making in people's lives. And, you know, at this point, I've got a stack of lift tickets this high, and just about anybody I ever meet, I'll tell them, if you ever want to come up, let me know. Like, I will give you a ticket.
Having a ball, don't stop me now. If you want to have a good time.
Find pictures of Seth Whitten in three-track action on the Spark page at WMRA.org.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus, Janet Trentner, Joy Loving, Rory and Jamie Kutaya, and an anonymous donor. You'll find all the stories from the WMRA newsroom and more information at our website, WMRA.org. Be sure to like us on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio for a heads up on our coverage. And you can follow me on Twitter at WMRA Bob. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll see you in the morning. The BBC News is next.